The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the June 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News titled, Educators Report Highest Level of Burnout Among All Other Industries. The new polling showing educators as the most burned out group among all other industries is the latest in a series of data points that underscores the fragility of the education workforce, by Lauren Camera, posted June 13, 2022. Amid a pandemic that's dramatically altered the American education system and exacerbated workforce stressors in K-12 schools and at colleges and universities, educators are now the most burned out group among all other industries. A new Gallup poll shows that 44% of K-12 employees say they always or very often feel burned out at work, including 52% of teachers who report the same. Moreover, 35% of college and university workers say they always or very often feel burned out at work, making K-12 and higher education the two industries with the highest rate of burnout, according to the new poll. The polling is the latest in a series of data points that underscores the fragility of the education workforce and comes at an inflection point for the country's public school system. One pushed to the brink by the coronavirus pandemic, overwhelmed with learning loss and mental health challenges, and overrun with contentious political debates, including, once again, whether to arm teachers in the wake of the most recent mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The coronavirus pandemic exacerbated many of the stressors for educators, especially at the K-12 level, forcing school districts to redirect central office staff to classrooms, ask recently retired teachers to return, and put parents on a rotating schedule to provide support in their children's classes. At least two states, New Mexico and Massachusetts, mobilized their National Guards to step in to teach, drive buses, and serve meals. National teachers' unions have been sounding the alarm on what they've termed an unprecedented staffing crisis across every job category. The 3-million-member National Education Association released polling in February that showed 55% of educators indicate they are ready to leave the profession. To be sure, the supply and demand issue in the educator workforce is not new. For decades, declining enrollment in teacher preparation programs has created persistent and mounting vacancies in schools. And compared to other professions requiring similar levels of education, teaching has experienced relatively flat growth, largely at the expense of rising retirement and health care benefits. The average starting salary for public school teachers in the U.S. is $41,163, according to the Learning Policy Institute. Though in 32 states, the average starting salary is much lower, including in Missouri and Montana, where it's less than $33,000. And in some states, teachers earn only 67% of what other college-educated professionals make. Last week, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona outlined his vision for revamping the teaching profession top to bottom, starting with increasing salaries for all educators, providing incentives for positions that have been historically difficult to staff, including for special education and bilingual teachers, and revamping teacher education programs to include more mentorships, hands-on experience, and concerted efforts to attract more students of color into the profession. As we support the whole child, we must also support the whole educator, Cardona said, taking time in his speech to acknowledge the stressors educators have been working through. The poll results, which come from Gallup's panel workforce study conducted February 3rd through 14th in 2022, with more than 12,000 U.S. full-time employees, including 1,263 K-12 workers, also documents how the burnout has risen among educators over the course of the pandemic. At the outset of the pandemic in March 2020, 36% of K-12 workers reported feeling burned out very often or always, 8 percentage points higher than the 28% found among all other workers as a whole. 2 years later, that gap has nearly doubled, with 44% of K-12 workers now reporting they feel burned out, compared with 30% of all other workers, a 14-point difference. Amid the recovery and all that is being asked of you today, teachers, you must take care of yourselves, Cardona said. Even as we carry the weight of caring for others, we must be good to ourselves so we can be good for the work. And so that in this most human of professions we are recognizing and protecting our own humanity. I often say, put your oxygen mask on before you put on others. And educators, you're such a giving and caring group. You gotta make sure you are taking care of yourselves and your families and your well-being. This next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, The Lost Graduate, Remembering a Student Gunned Down at School. An empty chair, a moment of silence, the poignant gestures to remember students who would have graduated this spring. By Catherine Gewertz, posted June 13, 2022. It's been 2.5 years since Jonathan Parker was fatally shot in the parking lot of his California high school. For his family, the pain comes in waves, and it's spiking again now as his classmates graduate. We see everyone getting ready for their prom, for graduation, all the senior festivities, and it just breaks our hearts, said Aurora Solario, Jonathan's aunt. Fused with the pain of his loss is fear that he'll be forgotten. Solario worked hard to ensure that Jonathan has a place in the graduating class at Deer Valley High in Antioch. The folding chair that would have held the tall boy with the streaming black hair instead held a photo of him adorned with a pair of angel wings. Solario made sure the yearbook included photos of him. She bought a cap and gown in his school colors of teal and black on Amazon. For families who have lost children, any milestone brings renewed waves of grief. Birthdays, Mother's Day, Father's Day, end-of-school-year rituals, and celebrations. School shooting incidents have taken the lives of 24 children this year alone, Ed Week's school shooting tracker shows. Graduation ceremonies have marked the absence of some of these young people. At Oxford High School in Oxford, Michigan, attendees at the May 19th commencement observed a moment of silence for 2022 class members Justin Schilling, 17 years old, and Madison Baldwin, also 17 years old, and two younger students who died when a fellow student shot them at the school on November 30th, 2021. Other chairs around the country are empty at graduations this year, too, because of gun violence. And with dozens of younger children fall into school shootings, there will be many more empty chairs at graduations for years to come. Each one marks an epidemic the country struggles to understand and address. The section is called A Chair for John John. On the football field at Deer Valley High, where commencement took place June 10th, a fabric seat cover was stretched over the metal folding chair where Jonathan would have sat had a 15-year-old student not shot him fatally outside a basketball game at his school on January 30th, 2020. A family friend had photoshopped the seat cover to include a graduation cap. When Deer Valley High officials announced Jonathan's name, his mother, Alicia Garul, came down from the bleachers to accept an honorary diploma for him. Solario said it was such an emotionally wrenching day that she wasn't certain her sister would be able to complete the walk to the stage and back. Solario wants Jonathan remembered fully, for his kindness, for the big teddy bearish presence the 6'4" teenager brought into a room, for the way he loved to spend weekend nights at home with his mom or his dad. The family has kept his memory alive with a string of giving back events in his honor. They raised $500 this year for a scholarship in his name. Last Thanksgiving, they fed 20 families. At Christmas, they adopt a family and give them gifts. On Jonathan's 18th birthday, they had a shoe drive and donated the shoes to needy families. This next section is called An Uphill Battle to Commemorate Slain Teenager. But it was an uphill battle to ensure that his high school acknowledged his place in the graduating class of 2022, Solario said. She asked school officials to provide information about ordering a cap and gown, a key element of a memory box she wanted to make for her sister. But by the time she got it, the deadline had passed, Solario said. Instead, she ordered them on Amazon. She asked if the family could display a picture of Jonathan on stage, but that request was turned down, she said. Deer Valley High Principal Bucky Oyebade noted in an email to Education Week that the school paid tribute to Jonathan in its 2020 yearbook and delivered that edition free of charge to the family's home. It also erected a plaque in his memory near the library, she said. This year's yearbook features a tribute to Jonathan as well, and the school awarded him a posthumous diploma, she said. In recognition that this is an emotional time for Jonathan's family, it is Deer Valley's sincere intent to honor Jonathan, the principal's email said. Still, Solario said, she wishes the school had initiated this year's remembrances of her nephew. They never reached out to us saying we want to remember Jonathan, she said. That hurts. This next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, A Landmark Case Ensuring Education to Undocumented Children Turns 40. A group of Texas Hispanic parents fought for their children's right to attend public school. The Supreme Court decision Plyler v. Doe ruled in their favor. The right to a basic education is a fundamental part of democracy, says historian Sonia Hernandez. This week marks the 40th anniversary of a court case that affected thousands of school children. Yet it's one that most Americans likely don't know about. In the 1970s, a group of Texas parents who lacked legal immigration status risked deportation to fight for their children's right to attend public school. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which on June 15, 1982, ruled in favor of the parents and their children. Plyler v. Doe ensured that children living in the U.S. without legal immigration documentation could access a basic education and lead more productive lives. It also paved the way for young immigrants to become active in efforts to demand legal pathways for children who have spent most of their lives in the U.S., such as the DREAM Act and the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA. Alfredo Lopez was in elementary school in Tyler, Texas in 1977 when his parents came to pick him up at school earlier than usual. "All I can remember is that we were sent home one day," he told American Public Media in 2017, "and they said we couldn't come back to school." In 1975, Texas had passed a statute allowing local school districts to deny enrollment to children who were not legally admitted to the country. 2 years later, the Tyler Independent School District decided that it would charge annual tuition for undocumented students like Lopez. At $1,000 per student, this was far beyond the reach of undocumented families. The section is called "Heavy Weight on My Shoulders." Backed by the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or MALDEF, four families agreed to sue the Tyler School District, then headed by Superintendent James Plyler. While a judge allowed the families to present their case under the pseudonym of Doe, the parents were required to testify in open court. This was risky. On the day that they testified, the Lopez family drove to court with their car packed with their possessions because they were afraid that they might be deported on the spot. When these families came forward to challenge the law, there was a real danger that people could find out their identities and harass them, said Peter Ruse, former National Director of Education Litigation for MALDEF. To avoid media attention, the judge scheduled the parents' testimony at the unheard-of hour of 6 a.m. In 1978, the federal district judge found that Texas's law was unconstitutional, and this ruling was upheld by an appeals court in 1980. By 1981, Peter Ruse was part of the team that argued the Plyler case before the Supreme Court. "The pressure was tremendous," he recalled. "I was confident in our case, but there was a sense that if we lost, other states would pass laws like Texas. So the outcome could affect millions of kids, and that was a heavy weight on my shoulders." The High Court sided 5-4 with the Mexican-American families in June 1982. "By denying these children a basic education, we deny them the ability to live within the structure of our civic institutions," Justice William Brennan wrote in the majority opinion, "and foreclose any realistic possibility that they will contribute in even the smallest way to the progress of our nation." The court found that undocumented children were entitled to equal protection under the 14th Amendment, so Texas could not deny them access to K-12 public education. This next section is called "A Firm Foundation." Ironically, even the losing party in this landmark decision came to believe that the case was decided correctly. In 2007, former Tyler School District Superintendent James Plyler told Education Week, "I'm glad we lost the Hispanic court case so that those kids could get educated." By then, his son had married a woman of Mexican descent, and Plyler himself had Latino grandchildren. The late legal scholar Michael Olivas, who wrote a book about the Plyler case, considered it the preeminent decision in immigration law. "This case is the high watermark for immigration rights," Olivas said in 2017. "It was courageous and strategic. Winning is one thing, but it's not static. It has to be fought for, it has to be defended, reconceptualized, and reapplied." Other legal experts and educators say that the Plyler case remains important and relevant today. "Plyler set a firm foundation, a baseline of rights protections for undocumented young people," said Roberto G. Gonzalez, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. "Its significance, in part, is that it allows undocumented children from day one to be integrated into the legal framework of this country. They not only get an education, but they learn the culture and values of this country and are integrated into the fabric of their communities." In 2019, the Migration Policy Institute estimated that there were 133,000 undocumented children, ages 3 to 17, in Texas. Nationwide, the Pew Center has reported that there are roughly 675,000 undocumented children. Yet the Plyler case has limitations, Gonzalez noted. Because the decision applied only to students up through the 12th grade, undocumented youth face an uncertain future after that. As these kids get older, they come in close contact with the limits of their sense of belonging. Undocumented youth in some states do not qualify for in-state college tuition, for example. In some states, they can get driver's licenses. In others, they cannot. According to Thomas A. Sains, President and General Counsel of MALDEF, the Plyler decision is well-established law. And we'll cut that article short for time. This next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, Hoax Shooting Threats Rattle New York Schools. A tactic using social media sites to direct threats at individual students has unsettled schools in New York City and around the country. By Andy Newman and Ali Watkins, published June 10, 2022, updated on June 11th. A 14-year-old freshman at Murrow High School in Brooklyn was sitting in history class one April morning when she got a string of chilling texts from a friend. A threat to shoot up the school had been posted on the chat site Omegle, and it included a list of about a dozen students who would be killed. One of them was the 14-year-old girl. To see your child's name on a literal hit list was truly the most completely devastating thing, said Jessica Heyman, the girl's mother. But the girl, whose name is being withheld, knew immediately that the threat was a hoax. Just days earlier, another threat had targeted students at another New York City high school, the Clinton School, using precisely the same language. The incidents at Murrow and Clinton were two in a string of nearly identical hoax threats aimed at more than a dozen New York City schools over the last 4 months, and at least 9 other schools nationwide, including ones in Long Beach, California, and Hicksville, New York on Long Island, according to parents, students, and 2 senior law enforcement officials. The New York schools include many of the city's most elite public and private schools, including the Brooklyn Friends School, Brooklyn Technical High School, and the Berkeley Carroll School in Brooklyn, and Beacon High School, LaGuardia High School, and the United Nations International School in Manhattan. As recently as this week, the police said, a threat was made against New Utrecht High School in Brooklyn. John Miller, the deputy commissioner for the police department's intelligence division, said the department was investigating 7 of these threats in New York City and coordinating with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is probing the threats nationally. These are not credible threats, Mr. Miller said. They're meant to cause disruption. The authorities believe the threats are made by a person, possibly overseas, Mr. Miller said, who finds the names of students at a school by searching Instagram for children with public accounts using rudimentary social media skills. Often, they pose as a student of the school that they are threatening, Mr. Miller added. The threat maker targets high-profile schools to gain attention, but does not appear to have any intention of following through, according to a separate senior law enforcement official, who spoke anonymously because he was not authorized to discuss the threats. We take every security-related incident seriously to ensure the continued safety of our students and staff, and we are working closely with the NYPD on their investigation of these threats, said Jenna Lyle, a spokeswoman for the Department of Education. For decades, American schools have had to contend with fake fire alarms, bomb threats, and threats to commit school shootings. But these hoaxes reflect a disconcerting new reality for a country already reeling from a mass violence epidemic. Social media has made it increasingly easy to craft eerily specific threats of violence that clog up one of the few avenues law enforcement has to police them. If the system becomes overwhelmed by false alarms, some could slip through, said Ron Avi Astor, a professor of social welfare who studies school violence at the University of California, Los Angeles. It takes away a big tool. The site where the hoax threats were made, Omegle, was also used sometimes by the gunman who killed 21 people at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The hoax threats posted on Omegle about New York City schools mentioned the type of assault rifle that would be used in a shooting and the music that would play, ABBA. The prevalence of hoax school shooting threats and an uptick following a particularly notorious or deadly mass shooting is not uncommon. For most of this school year, the city fielded an average of about 2 school shooting threats a day, the senior law enforcement official said. In the week following the Uvalde shooting, the number spiked to about 6 per day. Only a small percentage of these threats are serious. Others will make threats as a prank or in an effort to be disruptive. Not unlike previous generations that would pull a fire alarm or make a prank phone call, said Dewey G. Cornell, a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia who studies youth and violence. The stakes are higher now with social media and the tremendous anxiety that is generated by the threat of a school shooting. Notwithstanding the hoax threats, targeted school shootings are rarer at schools in big cities. A 2020 federal report found that while urban schools had more shootings overall, those shootings typically stemmed from disputes and happened outside the school building. The Department of Education spokeswoman, Ms. Lyle, said school officials at every school are trained in emergency response protocols and that, following a threat, schools typically introduce additional safety measures, including scanning and the deployment of additional NYPD school safety agents. After the hoax directed at Berkeley Carroll, a private school in Park Slope, Brooklyn, circulated in early February, the school increased security and allowed students to attend remotely for several days. But it did not close or lock down the school, telling parents it was following recommendations from the police. One disturbing feature of the threats is that they also named the student who will supposedly commit the attack. A couple of weeks before the Murrow High School threat, Chelsea Altman was awakened at her home in Brooklyn by a call from a detective in Long Beach, California. Her 14-year-old son, the detective told her, was named as the person who would shoot up a school there. She woke her son. It turned out that he already knew he had been falsely identified as a potential threat, but not at that school. He had learned the day before that he was named as the would-be attacker in the threat to the Clinton School in Manhattan. It took me a few minutes to unpack what actually happened and realize there's someone just doing this to scare everyone, Ms. Altman said. The Long Beach police said that the threat, made about Wilson High School on March 30th, was similar to the threats made against the high schools in New York, and that detectives, quote, determined there was not a credible threat. And we'll also cut this article short for time. This next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, Florida Teen Accepted into All 8 Ivy League Schools, 7 Other Top Universities, by Scott Gleason, posted June 13th, 2022. Getting admitted to one Ivy League school is a momentous feat in and of itself for any high school student. Florida teen Ashley Adarica, 17, decided to apply to all 8 of the prestigious schools last fall to test her chances. Acceptance letters kept piling in, and now Adarica has openings at Brown, Columbia, Cornell, Dartmouth, Harvard, Pennsylvania, Princeton, and Yale universities. Every single Ivy League school. The odds were surreal considering Harvard accepted just 3.2% of applicants, Columbia took 3.7% of its applicants, and Yale 4.5%. I just decided to shoot my shot at all of them and see if it would land, she told CNN. And I had no idea that I would get accepted into all of them. On Ivy Day, I remember crying a lot and just being extremely surprised. Ultimately, Adarica went with Harvard and plans to major in government this upcoming fall, the school confirmed. In high school, she was a student council president and on the debate team, according to CNN. Before the college application process, Yale was actually my top choice, she said. But when I did further research for what I want to do specifically, which is explorations in policy and social policy and things of that nature, Harvard just had a better program. Adarica, who graduated from Miami Beach Senior High School earlier this month, now joins an exclusive club of teens who garner the acceptance of all 8. Adarica, whose mother emigrated to the United States from Nigeria 3 decades ago, also got accepted to 7 upper echelon schools that included Stanford, Vanderbilt, and Emory. She credited her work ethic as coming from her mother's example in raising 5 children. Upon realizing she got into all 8 Ivy League schools, Adarica said, it was a family celebration. My siblings and I were just really excited, like screaming, jumping around. It was crazy, she told Good Morning America. The tears just started to come out. At her high school in Miami, Adarica founded Our Story, Our Worth, an organization that provides mentorship, confidence building, and sisterhood to girls and young women of color. And just to close out, here are a few articles and just the first or second paragraph from each. This article is from K-12 Dive, and it's called GAO, Pandemic Hurts Student Progress at All Grade Levels. Dive brief. Students across all grade levels and instructional models made less academic progress during the pandemic-strained 2020-2021 school year compared to a more typical school year, according to a teacher survey conducted by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Yet while 52% of teachers said they had more students start the 2020-2021 school year academically behind compared to a typical pre-pandemic year, respondents also reported some learners excelled during this time. Those who made progress benefited from more flexibility to work at their own pace and a supportive family environment. As the education field looks toward the start of the 4th school year impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, initiatives that strengthen student engagement, teacher capacity, access to technology, and family-school connections could help stem ongoing challenges and future learning disruptions, educators and parents told GAO researchers. This next article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, New Education Department Effort Aims to Elevate the Role of Parents in Schools. The Education Department is creating a parent council to help them better engage in their children's schools, a move that comes as Republicans tap into parents' frustrations over a third year of pandemic schooling and threaten to unseat Democrats as the party of education ahead of the midterm elections. Parents are a child's first teachers, and there's no one better equipped to work with schools and educators to identify what students need to recover, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said in a statement. The National Parents and Families Engagement Council will serve as an important link between families and caregivers, education advocates, and their school communities, he said. The council will help foster a collaborative environment where we can work together to serve the best interest of students and ensure they have the academic and mental health support they need to recover from the pandemic and thrive in the future. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, America's Most Hispanic State Weighs Benefits of Language Programs. Jacqueline Powell and her fourth grade classmates toiled over pencil and paper to write a letter in Spanish about what they did in class this year. Powell explained the assignment in perfect Spanish before struggling to translate the words to end her sentence. The 10-year-old charter school student raised her forearms to her temples in a show of mental effort, making her large round glasses seesaw up and down. That struggle, fought every week at the New Mexico International School in Albuquerque, has put her speaking ability far ahead of some of her high school peers. It has allowed her to speak in Spanish with her grandmother, who is from Chihuahua, Mexico, and she has fostered a secret language between her and her mom, whose husband and stepchildren can't speak Spanish. While dual language programs are offered in thousands of schools across the U.S., New Mexico is the only state where the right to learn Spanish is laid out in the Constitution. And the final article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, Middle Schoolers Write Pet Profiles to Help Find Homes for Shelter Dogs and Romeo the Rat. One worked at Gusteau's restaurant in Paris before boarding a cargo ship and sailing into the port of Virginia. Another has dreams of playing in the NFL and winning the Super Bowl. And another wants to star in a sci-fi flick. The ambitious bunch of animals are up for adoption at the Portsmouth Humane Society in Virginia. As of Thursday afternoon, the shelter has 91 dogs in the building. It's down to two open cages, and the shelter also has 46 dogs in foster care, said shelter director Amanda McQuarrie. According to the shelter's executive director, Allison Ficino, the group's engagement and development director asked teachers at Booker T. Middle School in Newport News for help recently. The teacher allowed 7th grade students to write profiles for the pets as part of an extra credit public service announcement assignment. Some readers have already inquired about pets who were featured, asking if some of the dogs are friendly with cats. Thank you to the students of Booker T. Washington Middle School for these unique, very interesting, amusing, and simply adorable profiles, wrote Facebook user Lynn Pridgen after reading what the students wrote. They all made me smile. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.